Hello and welcome to the Medical Women Podcast, the podcast from the Medical Women's Federation, the largest body of women doctors in the UK. I'm Dr. Nuthan Abayankaram, I'm the Vice President of MWF, and I have the honour and joy of being your host, as each week we hear from wonderful guests to help you feel more empowered and confident on your medical career journey. Hello everyone, I hope that you are all keeping very well. I don't know about you, but I can't believe that it's May 2023 already. Time just seems to be zooming past. And it's also the finale or last episode of, let's call it a finale. Why did I stop myself then? Finale of season three. And I just want to say thank you so, so much for continuing to listen to the podcast and for sharing your thoughts, sharing it with friends and colleagues, and for all the lovely comments and reviews that you send in, as well as also the comments for ways in which we can improve. I do read everything that comes in and I so, so appreciate it. It's I know I've said it several times before, but it's a bit of a strange medium with a podcast. I'm sitting at my dining table recording and I have absolutely no idea who's listening, what they're doing whilst they're listening, and the only way I know that is when people tell me. So please do continue to do that so that I get to have a two-way conversation with you rather than a one-way conversation. So this week's episode is a panel discussion from our recent MWF Spring Conference, and it was fantastically chaired by our president, Professor Scarlett McNally, and our junior doctor rep on council, Dr. Davina Maru. And when we were planning the conference, we were sort of seeing how we could help include more of our reps. And I said, oh, well, it would be great if we have some of them helping to chair sessions, because that then means that that we have more people that get the experience of doing that and developing their own leadership skills. So this panel discussion was all about how to be the future NHS workforce, discussing flexible working and SAS careers. And we had an amazing panel made up of Dr. Rob Fleming, who's a specialty doctor anaesthetist at Sherwood Forest Hospitals, Professor Camilla Hawthorne, MBE, who's the chair of the Royal College of General Practitioners, Professor Angharad Davies, who's a consultant microbiologist at Swansea. She's a clinical academic. Professor Partha Kaur, OBE, who is a consultant in diabetes and endocrinology at Portsmouth Hospital NHS Trust and the lead for diabetes at NHS England. And if you listened to last week's podcast episode, you would have heard his talk from the conference. And last but certainly not least, Dr. Vaishali Parulekar, who is the chair of the BMA SAS committee. So this was a really interesting and helpful discussion. I found it fascinating to learn about the changing workforce, and Partha mentioned this in his talk. So if you've not listened to last week's episode, definitely go and have a listen to that. But he mentioned that having an increase in international medical graduate colleagues and SAS doctor colleagues. And Dr. Anthea Mowat, who is our previous honorary secretary, did a wonderful episode about what are SAS doctors, which is in season two. So if you've not listened to that, I'll pop a link in the show notes, definitely have a listen. But these are groups of doctors who really are very, very important for the NHS workforce. I think they're kind of the backbone of the NHS, holding up the NHS really. And yet, a lot of the time when we organise events or we organise conferences, there isn't really a category that includes them. And when we're planning our workforce, it's vital that we make sure that all the different groups are included and represented. And I, for one, during medical school, I thought that the only option was I do F1, F2, I go into training, I finish training, and then I become a consultant or a GP. I didn't realize that there were all these different options. I'd never heard of SAS doctors and never really thought about, flexible working, so many different aspects. But we're celebrating the 75th anniversary of the NHS. And I think that is a wonderful milestone, and the NHS represents a beautiful institution, the only place really in the world where we're able to give treatment free at the point of care. It is a wonderful institution. And in 2023, the world is a very, very different place to how it was 75 years ago. And the NHS has been built on a model where the workforce was made up of men, essentially, who were doctors, and they had wives at home who were looking after the house and bringing up children. And now the workforce is very, very different. And yet we still have these structures from 75 years ago. So this is back to the thing that I say quite frequently, which is that these are system problems. We're not blaming individuals here, but there is a system problem. And at the same time, individuals can make a change and make a difference. And I think it's up to all of us to make a change. You know, we can't sit here waiting for somebody to come and make a change. I did a workshop last week at the Women in Leadership Conference run by the Academy of, it was on behalf of the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges, but organized by the Royal College of Surgeons and Royal College of Physicians of Edinburgh. And this was the first time that I had been invited to go and run a workshop at a conference. And so I was very excited. I'm very honored to have been asked to go. But my message was that we are all leaders, and it's all well and good sitting here saying, oh, well, it's a system problem. But sometimes I think what happens is we think, oh, well, it's a system problem. So A, it's too big for me as an individual to make a change. And B, I can't really make a change as an individual, so I need to wait for somebody else to come along and do it. But nobody is going to come along and make these changes. It's up to us to make the changes that we want to see. So I think this particular episode will be really helpful in that, because we clearly all need to work together to make these changes. I think we all want the NHS to continue to be a wonderful organisation that provides healthcare free at the point of entry. And I, for one, would like to keep working for another 30 odd years until I reach retirement age. But that's not going to happen if we don't actually support everyone to work differently. We can't be working at these structures that were built 75 years ago, because they're just not fit for us now. And over time, we might make a change now, and then that won't be the right thing in another 20, 30 years. And that's fine, but we have to keep making changes and make sure that things are relevant to what's happening now. And it's predicted that in the future we won't have enough healthcare professionals. So I think it's really important that we're having these conversations, which is why I was delighted that we had this session at the conference. And that's why I wanted to make it into an episode of the podcast. So I hope that you enjoy this episode, and I hope that you've enjoyed this series. The podcast will be taking a couple of weeks break for me to have a bit of a rest, and for Jenna to do her first year medical school exams, which we all wish her all the very best with. And then we will be back very, very soon in a couple of weeks with season 4. And I will be telling you all about that in the upcoming trailer. So thank you so much for listening. Enjoy this episode, and we will see you again very, very soon.
The panelists are going to introduce themselves. They've very distinguished bios, so it's easier if people introduce themselves and they're talking at the same time and people can see them. So is Dr. Robert Fleming there?
Hello, I'm assuming everyone can see me.
Perfect, yes.
That's good, that's a very good start. I just wanted to start by saying thank you very much to the organisers for inviting me. It's always lovely to share a stage or a virtual stage with such splendid people. My name is Rob Fleming. I am a specialist anaesthetist, which makes me part of a wider professional group called SAS Doctors. I work in Sherwood Forest Hospitals in Nottinghamshire. I am SAS advocate for my trust and part of the English SAS Advocate Network. And I'm also an elected board member, former SAS committee chair, and honorary membership secretary-elect at an organization called the Association of Anaesthetists. I write and present and tweet an awful lot about SaaS doctors and alternative career pathways. It's nice to see you.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. And next, Dr. Faishali Parulilaka, please.
First of all, yes, thank you, Scarlett and Medical Women's Federation, for inviting me to join this esteemed panel today. It's really my pleasure to join everybody. I'm Vaishali Parulikar. I'm Associate Specialist in Radiology in Oxford University Hospitals. I completed my postgraduate training in Mumbai, India, and I came here as international medical graduate. And after taking the basic qualifying exam, I chose to join the SAS career and became, I started in Oxford in 2005. I'm completely autonomous. I'm associate specialist. I'm autonomous and one of the senior medical workforce in Oxford Breast Imaging Center. And over the years, I've had many leadership positions within the trust and nationally as well. I'm the SAS rep for the local negotiating committee. I'm deputy chair for the Oxford Regional BMA committee. I'm the co-chair of SAS committee for Academy of Medical Royal Colleges and for clinical radiology for my Royal College of Radiologists. I've contributed to several reports as previous vice chair of the same committee for AOMRC. And that's sort of broadened my perspective and enhanced my passion for the SAS career. And I believe in this career and I have no regret. It's been a very, very enriching year for me. And thank you again for inviting me. Thank you.
Thank you. It's lovely to have you on the panel. Thank you. And next, I'd like to invite Professor Harad Davids to introduce herself. Thank you.
Hello. Thanks very much. And thank you as well for the invitation to contribute today. It's a real privilege to be able to join. I'm a clinical academic at Swansea University Medical School with an honorary consultant contract, a medical microbiologist with Public Health Wales. So I'm also a consultant microbiologist for the National Cryptosporidium Reference Unit and currently Vice President for Learning at the Royal College of Pathologists. I've developed an interest in EDI in clinical academia specifically. I'm deputy chair of the BMA's Women in Academic Medicine group and sat on the last UK Research Excellence Framework Equality and Diversity Advisory Panel. And for the last 3 years, I've been MWF's rep on the Academy of Medical Royal College's Flexible Career Committee. So it's great to be here. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you. And it's thank you very much for your work on that committee. And just to plug to anyone who's watching, we do have a number of committees that we're invited on as Medical Women's Federation that we send representatives to, for example, Professor Davids. So if this is something you're interested in, do contact us, because there aren't enough of us to go round to be responsible for a particular area. So it's quite a good way of developing your skills. Next, I'd like to invite Professor Camilla Hawthorne to introduce herself, please.
Hi, everybody, and thank you very much for inviting me onto this panel. It's a great honour. So, yes, my name is Camilla Hawthorne. I am chair of the Royal College of GPs for the last 3 months. I started in November last year, and I'm a working GP in Mountain Ash up in the Welsh Valleys. Prior to that, I was head of graduate entry medicine at Swansea University. So I'm Harrod and I have got a strong parting relationship and did an awful lot together. In my past, my research interests have been in working with ethnic minority communities in type 2 diabetes, starting initially in Nottingham, where I was a GP trainee, and then in Manchester, which was my second GP practice, and then converting that research into service delivery in Cardiff. So from that, I moved from health education for patients into medical education for medical students and postgraduate trainees. So that's how my career has progressed. I've moved many times. I'm the mother of two children who are now grown up. But again, the moves were mostly because I was following my husband as he moved up his hospital career. Initially, we started in Nottingham and then in Manchester and then in Cardiff. And I must say that when I arrived in Cardiff, I did say to him, if you move again, you're going on your own next time, because it really is quite a struggle starting in a new place where you don't know anybody. But anyway, it's all worked out really well. And the person who did move the next time was me when I moved to London to take up this job. So It's funny how life plays you tricks. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, thank you all of you for self-introducing yourself, because I've got pages and pages about everyone's accolades and what they've done and work, but it's great to hear the person as well, and particularly for our audience. So I should have mentioned the title of our panel, which is How the Future NHS Workforce, Flexible Working and SAS Careers, as a question. On that note, I'm going to kick off with the first question aimed at Professor Carr. What is the problem with NHS staffing? Big question. Thank you.
And how long is a piece of string? So I think if you break it down, what is the problem? Well, we don't have really much of a workforce plan. Last time I checked, that's a starting point. I think we appreciate a lot of people working in different sectors. I'm going to stick to, let's say, doctors to begin with. I don't think, from my working, I've been a national lead now for 7-8 years. I'm not quite sure primary care is appreciated the way it should be. And I say that as somebody who's worked in diabetes for a long time. So there's that. I don't think there is recognition as to how many people work from other countries to help us out. I've talked about SAS doctors. And finally, I don't think people realize that their women need flexibility in what's needed. So if you're not going to have, so those are the four planks. I mean, if you don't have a strategy to look after your primary care, your international medical, or look after your main tranche of people who are SAS doctors, well, guess what? It all falls apart. And then you have the protected characteristic issues. So I'll finish with this little bit. I've spoken a lot about racism. I've done this work for whatever 18 months, and I'm finishing at the end of this month. I've taken 21 cases that I've had to pick up, right, directly with chief execs. Of those 21, 18 were women, right, about some prejudice they've suffered, something that they've been stopped from doing. There is a problem. And I think keeping on ducking our heads from all levels saying it will be fine, it's not going to be fine like that. I think there's a lot to learn from other industries as to how they look after their workforce. And I just don't think we are mature enough in that space.
Thank you. That's very helpful, setting the scene. I'm also aware that there are tens of thousands of vacancies of medical staff, and there's almost a vicious cycle of people leaving or not being supported or rota gaps. And at the last flexible working committee that I attended, we're talking about considering the norm of being 80%, and that we should increase the number of doctors to cover that, because most people want to do the heroic model that people used to do in the past. So I'm going to hand over now to Davina to ask the next set of questions. Thank you.
Thank you. So the next question is for Dr. Robert Fleming. So for everyone on this platform, can you just explain what an SAS doctor is and how they could potentially be the answer to this NHS workforce?
Thank you. Can I start by saying I love the question, because I do indeed think that SAS careers have an enormous part to play in shoring up the future of the NHS medical workforce. So since the dawning of the NHS, there have always been doctors who were not consultants, were not GPs, and not in formal training programmes. These doctors have always existed. And for the majority of the history of the NHS, there have been national contracts for that work, and they have been the SAS contracts. So from the late 80s through to the late noughties, we had primarily staff grades and associate specialists, which is where we get SAS from. So it originally stood for staff and associate specialist. The staff grade was considered to be a more junior role, and the associate specialist role was the more senior role that staff grades could progress to. For most of my career, there has only been one SAS contract, which was the specialty doctor role, which is what I was until last week. So the overwhelming majority of SAS doctors now are specialty doctors. But there is now, after an awful lot of lobbying by an awful lot of organisations, some of which I do work for, there is now a senior role again. So existing specialty doctors should be expected to progress to the new senior SAS specialist role. So that leaves us with two national contracts for doctors who are not consultants, not GPs, and not in formal training programs. How this is the future of the medical workforce? Well, I think if people knew more about the contract structure, and if the contracts, if doctors who were on those contracts were better supported to progress their careers, I think this is an incredibly attractive alternative route for a career within medicine. So the specialty doctor role, for example, requires only 4 years postgraduate experience, 2 in your specialty. Ideally, that should have been undertaken within a formal training program, but equivalent experience and competence would be acceptable. So if you've achieved the end of kind of CT2 within your specialty, that's what it would be called in anaesthetics, it varies from one specialty to the next, then you could conceivably choose to progress your career within one organisation as a specialty doctor. You could have geographical stability, the right to a job plan, the right to SPA time, and an expectation of professional development within one organisation rather than another 6 or 7 years of rotational training. I think if people knew that that was an option that was open to them, it would be a very attractive option to an awful lot of people. And the single biggest barrier to it being something that's accessible to more people is a lack of knowledge based among both among organisations and among doctors themselves, which is why I make myself so busy trying to raise awareness of the contracts, the national documents describing what's supposed to happen to SAS doctors. And because I think it would benefit everyone. It would benefit existing SAS doctors, and it would benefit anyone who finds themselves at a fork in the road within their own career, deciding what they want. I see this as a natural progression of, you know, less than full-time working or more flexible careers. This would give people the right to choose to develop within one organisation. And there are an awful lot of us who've done exactly that. So the majority of my career as an anaesthetist has been outside of a formal training programme. I've progressed and developed as an anaesthetist into furthered my clinical roles, furthered my non-clinical roles, and progressed to what I would consider to be a senior, independent, experienced anaesthetist. But I'm not on the specialist register, I'm a senior SAS doctor. And that is my career, and that could be the career of anyone.
Thank you for eloquently explaining what SAS doctors are for everyone and your career journey in it. And I think the next question nicely fits into Dr. Vishali. Dr. Vishali, how can an individual SAS doctor progress, and how can institutions make this easier?
Thank you, Davina. That's an excellent question. We all know that SAS career, SAS workforce has got, it's a very diverse group, and there are lots of unconventional career paths, and more than 50% are international medical graduates. And although we have highly skilled and experienced group, it has been the most overworked and most undervalued group historically. It's nice to see that the culture is changing. There is a positive shift, and SAS seems to be the buzzword now, because I think it's the fastest growing workforce, as the data can show us. So I think the SAS doctors individually can have a very good and enriching career. But what SAS workforce sort of has, some of them can be senior trainee-like, and some of them can be very experienced and autonomous and consultant-like. So I think to progress from A to B, the junior SAS specialist doctors have to sort of start with small professional networks with your SAS tutor. You need to know who your SAS advocate is, who your SAS tutor is. You need to have the knowledge locally. If you don't have the knowledge, you will never have the opportunities, and you can never ask for support. So that is very, very important. GMC survey has showed us that 4 out of 10 SAS doctors do not have support for their CPD, which you require for your revalidation and your professional development. So if you're considering SAS as an alternative career, you need to have that visible trajectory, just as the consultants have. And I think another important thing is, as Rob said, we have the specialist contract and the new specialist role, which is a very, very fulfilling sort of endpoint for the SAS career. And there is a generic capability framework that we need to have to progress to the specialist role. And one of the important thing for that is being autonomous. So I think we need to have all the low. We need to sort of have autonomous working policy within our trust, and SAS local groups need to make sure that the trusts do that. Also, you need to take you need to see if there are any opportunities for leadership or educational roles within your trust or nationally. You need to grab them. So those are the things that the SAS doctors can do at an individual level. The second part of the question: what can institutions do? Well, they can do a lot. First of all, they by starting to value and recognize this workforce. And you need to have that sense of belonging and inclusion, and only then you will feel part of a greater team. And I think it's up to the employers to create that sort of environment for the SS doctors where they feel they can raise any concerns, they have a voice, and that will be heard, and just as the consultants have. So I think that is very, very important. Specifically, we can leadership roles like SS tutors and SS advocates should be really offered to the SS doctors rather than consultants. Also, leadership and educational roles that we have in the trust should be person specific rather than grade specific. So there should be equity to the SS, and it should not be just specific to the consultants. There are lots of things that employers can do, like they can have the SS strategy, which can be a live document, and it can look at a lot of national data, national reports, and how to implement that at local level, because we see that there is a lot of work done nationally. We have SS leaders nationally, but sometimes it does not really reflect on ground level, and at local level, there is no change. We don't even have SS charter at local level sometimes. So I think there is a lot that the employers can do to support the SS workforce. I think that's very, very important. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie. Top tips for both individual and institution levels. Thank you. I'm just going to hand over to Scarlett to ask the next question to our panel member.
Grant, so the next question is Professor Davies about flexible working. And the question really is options at all different levels. There's options at different stages of the career. I wondered if you could run through those with any hints and tips as well. Thank you.
Yes, definitely. So there are options to work less than full time at pretty much all stages. For example, I've got three school aged children, and I'm currently contracted to work 0.7 FTEs for the university plus 0.1 in another role with Health and Care Research Wales. But the 2022 Gold Guide makes it clear that all trainees are also entitled to ask to work less than full time. And that includes foundation doctors and academic trainees, as well as specialty trainees. And you no longer have to give what used to be called a category one reason, such as caring responsibilities, to be able to request this. And this is something that MWF strongly supported on the Academy's Flexible Careers Committee, because by making less than full-time working available outside of those quite constrained categories, it makes it much more possible for men as well as women to take less than full-time roles, which is really something to be welcomed. So the only requirement is that you need to provide a what's described as a well-founded individual reason that can include welfare and well-being reasons or non-medical professional development, such as various courses, and all these well-founded reasons will be considered. There are a few things just to bear in mind. The availability of this provision may be somewhat dependent on the capacity of the programme and the resources that they have. And the less than full-time roles have to reflect the same balance of work as the full-time colleagues have. So on call, for example, would be undertaken pro rata, the same as the full-time colleagues would be doing. And you can't necessarily choose precisely which days or hours you want. So you can't pick and choose completely. It needs to be agreed with your host employer or host organisation. And also you'd still normally be expected to move between placements within rotations that on the same basis as the full-time trainees. The good news is that all training is now supposed to be competency-based, particularly for CCTs, which used to be on the basis of time served. It's now competency-based. So again, you may be able to obtain your competencies within that time. Again, this is something that has to be negotiated with your trust and your deanery. In terms of tips. I think it's a good time to take a chance to highlight a few EDI-related pitfalls when moving between NHS and clinical academia for those of you who are thinking about an academic career. And I'm only too aware of these because I've encountered a lot of them myself. And one of these pitfalls is the eligibility for occupational employment rights, such as paid parental leave. You can imagine how horrified I was to find that for my first period of maternity leave, I wasn't eligible for occupationally paid enhanced maternity leave because it happened to coincide with a move from the NHS to university employment. Even though I still had substantial clinical commitments to the NHS under my honorary clinical contract, I naively considered that I wouldn't therefore lose my paid NHS maternity leave rights. So that came as a huge shock to me, and I was pretty upset about that at the time, having worked very hard in the NHS for 13 years at that point. So that's just something to be aware of. There are ways to manage this. If you're a trainee and you get a clinical training research award from one of the big national funders like the MRC or Wellcome or NAHR, there is a stipulation now since 2018 that if you're switching as a trainee for one of these awards between NHS and academic employers, your benefits will be maintained as though you hadn't changed employer. Although those organisations did feel a need to write to universities to remind them of this stipulation, because they were sometimes trying to get out of that. However, so that's for trainees. So things are a lot better for trainees now. But at consultant level, that doesn't exist. So it's just something to watch out for when you're switching between employers. So that would be my tip. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I just follow up with that about there's a lot of issues, particularly for women coming back after maternity leave and kind of support for ramping on and ramping off. I understand that only 2% of men or the second parent take the shared parental leave. And MWF is quite keen that men should also take some of the burden of childcare and shared parental leave. Can you explain a little bit about shared parental leave and how we could get our male colleagues and partners? Thank you.
Yes. So shared parental leave, as the name suggests, is where occupational parental leave benefits are shared by both parents rather than just the mother taking the time as mat leave. And that's been a statutory right since 2015, where parents can share a maximum of 50 weeks of leave between them. And as you say, MWF has strongly supported this. It really normalises the idea of fathers taking equal responsibility for childcare and sets the precedent from the outset. But there are still a few problems with shared parental leave, and one of them is the one that you've pointed out, which is that take-up is really, really low. Very few couples take advantage of it. And MWF supports that there should be a use-it-or-lose-it element to shared parental leave, where some of the benefit is specific to fathers, so that they have to take it if they want to take advantage of the full offer in terms of the time. And this is the approach that some Scandinavian countries have taken, such as Iceland, and it has increased the take up quite markedly. So that is something that I think would be greatly welcomed.
Thank you. And over to Davina, thank you.
Thank you. So my next question is for Professor Camilla Hawthorne. So I'm a GP trainee by background too. So general practice is already seen to enable flexible working. What else can it do to stop people leaving the profession?
So Davina, really nice to see you. I think that, of course, the bottom line is that we need more GPs. That will make such a difference to our working lives, all of our working lives. But until that day comes, because there's no sign of the cavalry coming over the hill there, there are various things. In fact, Lucy has put some of this into the chat already, so maybe she's answering the question for me, but this is really, it's about attitude and culture to flexible working. So I've been a GP now for 34 years. I've always designed my own flexible working, I must say. Sometimes at times when it wasn't that easy to do, but my flexibility was sort of put upon me because I had to keep moving cities. And so I could start again somewhere else and sort of work out again what I needed at the time for myself and my family. But I think that, you know, we do need to be more kind to each other in medicine in general, but I'm talking particularly about general practice, because, you know, I remember many mornings standing in school playgrounds waiting for the bell to go at 9 o'clock because your child feels that you've deserted them if you leave before 9 o'clock, and yet you've got to be in surgery to start at 9 o'clock because that's what your partners expect of you. And that was a really difficult place to be, really, all the time, not wanting to be in the playground when actually I should have wanted to be in the playground and enjoyed seeing my child running around until the bell went and they lined up and went inside. So I think, you know, things such as more flexible approaches to working, that work that starts perhaps a little bit later in the morning to allow a mum to get into work, to finish in time to pick up her child from school, that sort of thing would help tremendously. And it just takes the pressure off people, makes it less likely that at some point they'll say, I'm just going to throw in the towel, I've had enough of this. We've seen the same sort of thing with GPs retiring in their mid to late 50s. So in one of the practices I was in Cardiff not so long ago, there were two female partners who were getting into their 60s. They wished to retire, but they could see that as a practice, we desperately needed people. We desperately needed doctors. And in the end, what they did was to broker a deal with us that worked really well for everybody. It enabled our practice to survive. And it meant that for 4 or 5 years, they carried on working with us, seeing patients at longer appointment intervals. They didn't do any house calls, they didn't do any paperwork, they just saw the patients and they enjoyed that. They just did mornings, but it was enough to keep us afloat for a few years longer. So, you know, there are lots of things there. And of course, now post-COVID, we have learnt about virtual working in a way that we never quite, you know, we had it with organisations like Babylon. But, you know, many of us were a bit sniffy. I don't think that's the case anymore. And there are lots and lots of young doctors who are working evenings and weekends because that fits better with their home conditions and their home requirements. So there's lots going on there. There's much more that we can do, of course. It's things like just improving our work balance in surgeries, reducing the bureaucracy. We do an awful lot of needless box ticking. Certainly as a college, we're constantly lobbying NHS England and government to change the QoF. For those of you who don't know what QoF is, it's a way of managing chronic conditions in which GPs are paid for almost an item for service. And there are at least, there were 70 plus of these boxes. Now they're 50 plus, but essentially you don't get paid unless you tick the box. And some of them really don't show any particular benefit for patients or really for doctors other than the funding that comes in. We know also that bringing in allied healthcare professionals into practices is useful. But there's some early research coming out from Manchester that seems to show that it's not really reducing GP's workload that much. If anything, what's happening is that we're increasing what we can offer to patients, the services we can offer to patients, but it's not actually meaning that GPs are seeing fewer people. And of course, they're having to supervise these allied healthcare professionals as well. So we need to find better ways to use all these people who are coming into general practice to help us, in inverted commas. Well, we need to make sure that they really do help us, and there's stuff to be done there. We also know, and again, this is fairly new research, that providing continuity of care gives more job satisfaction. I mean, I suppose it's intuitively obvious that it should do, but it is now published research that it does. And I think, you know, this is about seeing the same people, getting to know them, getting involved with them getting to know you. It is that delightful doctor-patient relationship that certainly in general practice means that patients talk about my GP rather than the GP. There is just one last thing that I'd really like to tell you about, because, you know, things have changed a lot in the 34 years that I've been a GP. I think it is easier to be flexible now. I think it's sad that we have more people leaving the profession than we have joining it, because, of course, it just becomes almost a vicious circle, doesn't it, that it makes things worse and worse and worse. We need good leadership. We need people to stand up and speak. And that's not just me as chair of the college. All of us will get opportunities to stand up and speak, and we need to. And I need all of you to support me and to work with me to make sure that we survive as a profession. But I did want to just point you to something which you can find on the internet, which I found a couple of years ago and have used often, and it's really inspiring because we're standing on the shoulders of giants today. And one of them was Dame Claire Marks, the former chair of the GMC. And I found a clip online of her giving an interview in 2015 to somebody from the King's Fund, Vijay Nath. And it's called Challenges Facing Women in Medicine. So if you Google Claire Marks, King's Fund, Challenges Facing Women in Medicine, you'll find it. And it is a beautiful clip that talks about many of the things that we're talking about today. And she says it ever so much better than I ever could. So please do watch it. Thank you.
Thank you, Camilla. I'll definitely be Googling that, Challenges Facing Women in Medicine. Definitely. Thank you. So there were loads of questions in the chat, and thank you, Kate, for signposting the SAS Charter and the Academy of Medical Royal College's documents about SAS careers as a useful resource too. But going back to the initial questions, I'm going to try and go in order. So it's by Susan, and she had a question for Rob on the panel specifically. She said, have there been problems with the introduction of new SAS doctor roles on the ground in the trusts?
The short answer to that would be a resounding yes. Yes, there have been some problems getting the new SAS contracts implemented across trusts. And sadly, the SAS contract reform for England, Wales and Northern Ireland occurred essentially mid-pandemic. Scotland may have been marginally more sensible by holding theirs back for the better part of a year and launching their contracts a little bit later. But basically what happened is that the new contracts launched at a point where everyone was slightly distracted by other things. And this has led to a variety of minor and some more major problems. So for existing specialty doctors, so for specialty doctors on the contract that was available from 2008 until 2021, they had the opportunity to transfer over to the new specialty doctor contract. For some doctors, this will have made financial sense or contractual sense for them, for others, not so much. Existing associate specialists who'd been created before 2008 had the opportunity to transition over to the new senior role, the specialist role. And again, some will have done so, but I think the majority chose to keep their existing contract. And probably the single biggest implementation problem we've got is that in none of the four nations has there been any means for existing senior specialty doctors to progress to the new senior role without a job being created and advertised and applied for, which means that there are a large cohort of doctors who are now very clearly and very obviously working beyond their contract. This is a problem for a number of reasons, not least of which because it's overwhelmingly affecting doctors of BME ethnicity and international medical graduates. So I personally think this would be a scandal if it were more widely known. So at the moment, yes, the biggest implementation problem is trying to convince employers and organisations that they need to recognise their existing seniority via either internal processes or by agreeing to advertise jobs so that people can progress to the right contract for their work. And I would encourage anyone who is listening to go back to your employing organisations and make this a priority, because this is affecting an awful lot of doctors. And in a workforce crisis, we could probably do with recognising the senior ones who already exist in order to retain them within our workforce.
Thank you, Rob. And the next question is by Lucy, and she said it's a question to all panelists, but particularly Camilla. So we might start off with Camilla then. She's said, how can we collectively change the culture and the language within the NHS to help enable each doctor to flourish?
Wow, what a question. Lucy, I think the best way really is by speaking up in the way that you do. The way I hope I do, it's about having good role models. I think it's about making sure that we bring this up and talk about it regularly and openly. We spend a lot of time through sort of GMC guidance being really good with patients, but we're not actually very good with each other. And there are times when we're really not at all good with each other. And I think that that is something, it's just such a shame, really. There's no harm in being kind to each other and helping each other, such as within a practice, for example, not getting too wound up if somebody needs to come in a little bit later so that they can drop their child off at school. It's that kind of thing. And I do remember all those years ago, the real upset I gave my partners when I announced I was pregnant. And that was very much along the lines of, oh, but you said that you're going to travel the world. You never said you're going to have a baby. And, you know, it does make you feel guilty for starting a family. And I was 30. It wasn't as if I was that young. So, you know, I think it's that sort of thing. And even though I really enjoyed those partners and I really enjoyed that practice, you don't forget such things.
Thank you, Camilla. And I can see Lucy's even set up a website to help people, www.welcomebacktowork.co.uk. Is there anyone else from the panel would like to add to what Camilla said? How can we collectively change the culture and the language within the NHS to help enable each doctor to flourish?
I can add if you want. I think, you know, a lot of us are senior enough in the situation and the position. I personally don't think that a lot of us challenge when we see poor behavior. I think there's a lot of us who would want to do the right thing, but we see it around you. That doesn't happen. So if you want to change that culture, it starts from your own department. If you see something which is not right, you say it. And I think all of us on the panel will have seen multiple examples where they're thinking, somebody needs to speak up. Somebody needs to say something when it's against you. Nobody is, and they're supposed to be your allies. So you'll hear this a lot. We hear this a lot in NHS England. There's a term which is like, oh, there's a bigger picture. And I've never been able to find out what this bigger picture is. And I've been there for 8 years. I'm not sure what the bigger picture is and where it ends. So I think my philosophy is that, you know, if you see it in your workplace, which challenges your values, you say it. And I think that's how you do the change in small spheres.
Thank you. And I can see Rob with his hand up. Go ahead.
I'd come back on Partha's point and say that, in my opinion, the bigger picture is that we are in a workforce crisis and we are currently hemorrhaging colleagues. And anything that is costing us colleagues out of the workforce, be it racism, sexism, the inability of doctors to progress their careers, well, that seems like a very foolish way to run a healthcare service when we don't have enough people to begin with. Coming back on the conversation about culture and language, this is something that I speak an awful lot about when it comes to doctors who are not in formal training programs. An awful lot of what happens to locally employed doctors and SAS doctors comes down to culture, be that organizational culture, be that departmental culture. And an awful lot of what I do in the wider world is trying to change that culture. This is why I speak so much about alternative career pathways rather than discrete jobs or roles, because I think doctors who find themselves outside of formal training programs could very easily become stuck. And there have been an awful lot of documents written over the last decade about maximising the potential of this aspect of the workforce. And that relies on the fact that we all, as individuals and as organisations, recognise that the professional development of doctors, be they in formal training programmes or outside of formal training programmes, be they GPs or consultants, that our own individual professional development is vital, because today's service is always the priority, but actually what we need to consider is what the service need of 5 and 10 years' time is. And today's service absolutely should not pay the price for 5 or 10 years down the line. Individuals need the ability to progress and develop, and the kind of culture for SAS and locally employed doctors, sadly, is often that they are in non-training roles or considered to be perpetual middle grades. And both of those things are very damaging, because all of those doctors are future senior colleagues until proven otherwise. And if we were to support the professional development of people outside of formal training programs a little bit more, we'd have an awful lot more future senior colleagues.
Thank you, Rob. And this next question, I'm going to hand it over to for Charlie. So this question was by Jotty, and she said, I'm a GP, but also a SAS doctor in hospital breast clinic. flexible working is possible, but pay is a big discrepancy for non-training SAS doctors. Are there any guidelines around this? Are there any thoughts on the role of HEE in SAS career progression? And what could be done to improve this?
I think that's a good question. Thank you, Jyoti. Yes, a lot of GPs are with special interests are doing SAS clinics. I do breast imaging, and I see a lot of GPs doing sort of surgical clinics as breast physicians. And I think there is a lot of SAS in primary care. That is something that like scoping exercise has been starting. I think that is something when we discuss this, we will need to consider the different pay grades that the SAS have compared to the GPs. And that is something we do need to take into account and get it right the first time if we are planning this as a futuristic workforce. And I think that is something we do need to consider. And we are doing a lot of work with Royal College of GP and GMC to actually tackle this problem. The second question was about the HEE. I think HEE has done a lot of work about supporting the SS doctors. And as Rob mentioned, the Maximizing Potential came out in 2019, and there were several commitments and in different domains. And we have in Academy did a lot of work to actually look at these commitments to see what can be done to fulfill these commitments. There is a lot of discrepancy between Royal Colleges in offering educational and clinical supervisor roles. Some colleges have good practice and some not so good. And I think there is a lot to learn from each other in this. We also see that if you look at these commitments, you see all these national documents, but if you see at the ground level, at the trust level, one of the important ones is SS Charter, and SS Charter has not been implemented in the local level. So I think we do need to know the next thing would be how to implement these recommendations from national documents at local level. And I think that is the crux of the matter. We have a lot of publications with all good recommendation, but the important discussion will be how do we bring this in practice? And there's a lot of work to be done by employers, by stakeholders, but a lot of work to be done by SS workforce themselves as well. I don't know if you want to add anything, Rob, to this.
I would say that the implementation of national rhetoric into the day-to-day life at the coalface of the typical SAS or local employed doctor should be a massive priority for future workforce planning. You know, the new contract structure and all of the national documents support the idea of people reaching their individual potential outside of formal training programs, if that is their choice. But we're not very good at it. And we're very good at telling people that they're just for service and keeping people at A level for their entire careers. Whereas actually, in my opinion, and in the opinion of both the contract structure and all of the national documents about SAS careers, being a SAS doctor should allow us to develop an extraordinarily large number of future senior colleagues and allow people choice. And I think, you know, really that's the crux of it. If we were to better support SAS careers, we wouldn't have a training number shortage, because an awful lot of people would choose to develop their career within one organisation rather than rotating for 8 or 9 years. And I think that is an important part of future workforce planning for all of us, is recognising that if we are reliant on HEE-funded national training numbers to generate the next generation of senior colleagues, we're going to have far fewer of them.
Thank you. The next question I'm going to direct to Professor Angarad. So are there any particular considerations about less than full-time in academic posts? And how can men undertake more childcare? So two questions there.
Shall I start with the considerations in academic posts? So I've already mentioned about being beware of the changes when you're changing employers and the changes that might happen to your accrued occupational benefits. Another pitfall and a consideration for less than full time in academia specifically is that academia is quite different from the NHS in terms of on the good side, it's there's potentially more flexibility in terms of when you carry out your work. But that works both ways. And on the other hand, there is just no end to what you can do. And for a lot of that work, there's no cover from other people when you're not there. And by its very nature, it has a nasty habit of sucking you into work extra hours all the time that you're not contracted for. And that goes for the full-time academics as well as less than full-time. You may find that you want to achieve more than you can fit into your hours. And of course, your medical school will be delighted with that arrangement. So you really need a will of iron and a lot of self-discipline to avoid being in that situation. And something which I perhaps haven't managed as well as I could have at some times. And maybe I'm not a very good person to take advice on that. But I'd say be very, very careful about that and consider the nature of your role. If the role is to go into a medical school for certain agreed sessions and deliver a session of teaching, you should be able to keep that under control. But if it's a more wide ranging or general role than that, then you have to give that very careful consideration. And the other question was about fathers. Yes. So I did see a comment in the chat about saying, don't the Scandinavian countries give overall parental leave for longer? That is true, the case, I think. I know that in Sweden, the overall parental leave is 480 days, which is more than here. But 90 days of that, which is 3 months, of course, is specifically for the father only. So only the father can have that. If you don't have that, you lose those 90 days. I think that's very, very progressive. It sets the scene not only for the parent, for the new parents and for the childcare of their child going forward, sets a precedent for them. It also sets and changes the expectations among employers that parents are not only women, not only women take parental leave, not only women have to go on maternity leave, it applies to fathers as well. So I think it's very important in changing the perceptions of the parents themselves, but also society more generally. So that's why the Medical Women's Federation supports that. I absolutely agree that we need to make sure that fathers are involved in childcare as much as possible. That's good for everyone. It's good for both the parents, it's good for the child, and it's good for society.
Thank you. I'm going to hand it back to Scarlett now, and we're going to end on the take-home points.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to invite each of the panelists to give a very short take-home point about the future NHS workforce. So starting with Partha, please.
I think be aware of people around you, and I think follow through in what you say. I'm not saying it to the panel, but if people say things that sound right, and I think follow through that in your real life, whether people are disadvantaged because of their race, their sex, their position. We all do talk about what needs to be better. Data would suggest that that's not quite working out. So maybe I think that's the only bit. Do the bit in your own little space. That would be my message.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much. Rob?
I'm going to keep it very brief. My take-home message from most of my talks is always that there is more than one way to be a doctor. And I think that that pretty much sums up my perspective on life.
Thank you. That's really helpful, particularly when people are struggling, which a lot of people are, that choices are still available. That's really helpful. Vaishali.
Thank you. My take home message is putting my SAS experience. So I feel status quo, what has been happening with the SAS careers is not an option any longer. It is going to be one of the strongest workforce of the future. And from my personal experience, being an international medical graduate from a BAME background and being a woman, if I could achieve what I could, then I think anything is possible. So that's my take home message.
That's lovely. Thank you. Hangarad?
So my take home message is for clinical academics working less than full time, which is basically to be very self-disciplined. You need more self-discipline to successfully work less than full time than you do to work full time. So that's my message.
That's really helpful. Thank you. And Camilla.
So when I look back over my career, I think I have been discriminated against, both on grounds of my colour and my sex. But it's always been difficult to really pinpoint it, just as Partha was saying in his talk earlier. You know, it's very nebulous sometimes and difficult to pinpoint. But, you know, what I would say to everybody out there is be confident. Have confidence in yourselves and your abilities. Because I've spent so much time worrying about what the future would bring that I didn't need to do, really. And my advice would be flexible and be ready to change tack if you need to. You need to duck and weave a bit sometimes to get to places you want to go. And sometimes the choices you make are forced upon you. They're not necessarily the choices you want. And sometimes the choices are the choices you want. And it's about being flexible and being able to sort of move in the direction eventually that you want to go in. And I always remember, I think one of the best bits of advice I ever got was from, wasn't directed at me particularly, it was in a leadership course I went on some years ago. And it was the vice chancellor, I think from Hull University. And he said, and this is the only bit I remember of the whole course, was he said, if you can't go upwards, go sideways. And that stuck, and it has actually been very helpful.
Thank you. That's very wise. And it's been an absolute pleasure to listen to all the different ideas and positivity and different ways of looking at the future and different ways one can work oneself. I'm going to hand over to Davina to close this session.
Thank you, Scarlett. I'd like to thank every panel member here today. Very inspirational. We've learned about more about SAS roles, less than full time, academic careers, maternity leave, paternity leave. And it's very inspiring. And I liked Camilla's last comment, if you can't go upwards, go sideways. I'm going to end with that quote as well. I thought that was very inspiring. Thank you all.
Thank you so much for listening to the Medical Women podcast. Make sure to subscribe for free on whichever podcast platform you listen on so that you automatically get our episodes. The aim of this podcast is to support and empower as many medical women in their careers as we possibly can. So please share this episode with at least one other medical woman. If you're interested in joining the Medical Women's Federation, we would love to have you. And all links to our website and social media are in the show notes. This podcast has been produced on behalf of the Medical Women's Federation by Dr. Nuthana Bayankaram and Miss Jenna McKenzie. Our music was composed and played by Dr. Kethaki Bayankaram. Thank you so much for listening.